Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 186. Getting close to murder with that one.
Mm-hmm.
Today on the show, we have the regular crew. Of course, Mr. James Jones.
Hey.
John Lindemann.
Holla.
And Greg Lay.
Ahoy, hoy.
All right. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and I'm going to kick off our new business this week with Mega Man 10. It's the new hotness. It just came out, and I've only played through about... I think I've beaten 4 or 5 of the Robot Masters.
So basically, you've already put John to shame, essentially.
Probably.
It's not hard to do.
Yeah, I mean, I've played every Mega Man game, pretty much, very few exceptions. So, yeah, I mean, I just jumped into this and, you know, pretty much knew what I was doing from the start. I mean, I think I did play 3 stages before I finally beat a boss, but that's normal. In fact, that's pretty quick to find a weak point in the armor, you know. I had to use an E-tank, but I found it in the stage anyway. And I have no qualms about buying extra lives and energy tanks and mega tanks and stuff like that. Just, I never have. I mean, they're in the game. The game is balanced so that you can use those, and they don't break the game. I mean, you still have to watch boss patterns and stuff like that. But yeah, Mega Man 10 is a lot like Mega Man 9 and all, you know, et cetera, back to Mega Man 2, really. But 10, some people in the forums were talking about this, because this is going to be the next game club on Newscast, so I'm not going to steal too much thunder from them, but there was someone in the forums mentioned that, it might have been Zach Miller, he said that Mega Man 10 feels a little more like the latter-day NES Mega Mans, like 4, 5, and 6, and just that it's a little bit zanier than 9 was in terms of, you know, you got Strike Man who's shaped like a baseball glove, and you've got Sheep Man who's a freaking sheep, except he's also a cloud that shoots lightning, and his stage, God, Sheep Man's stage is so funny. It's all like bits and like weird characters, ASCII characters and stuff, and the first enemy that you meet on that stage is a mouse cursor that draws blocks that then fly at you.
It's really annoying too.
Yeah, those guys are hard to kill. But that stage is so wacky.
I'm glad that robots are being designed in the future for their usability and functionality, as opposed to just designed on the whim of some guy who's had way too much alcohol.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is that stage, especially Sheep Man, I feel like that's something that would fit really well in Mega Man X. You know, where the stages tend to be a lot more techno focused and a little more surreal oftentimes, you know, in terms of just the decorations and the design and the having strange enemies that seem to be made out of code.
Cyber Peacock comes to mind, yes.
Now, James, I know you're a pretty big Mega Man fan. Have you been playing this as well?
I have not gotten it yet, which is saddening, but
yeah.
it's on the list of things to play, but that is a very long list at the moment.
I hear you. Well, knowing what you have been playing, I'm not surprised that you've been blocked out from everything else, but more on that later. Yeah, Mega Man 10, it's still really good. I think the music's great. I think the level designs are really good in this one. Actually, not every level has a mini-boss, but the ones that do, the mini-bosses are freaking crazy.
Yeah.
They're really cool. They're really fun. You end up kind of doing things on them that you may not have ever done before in a Mega Man game, just in terms of the way platforms are arranged and, mm-hmm. you know, how it seems like you have to jump up high to actually shoot at the mini boss. You have to find some way to get up higher to do that. I've been really impressed with some of that stuff.
Yeah, what I really like the fact that, I mean, they're not just kind of straightforward. You typically, when you first encounter them, you really have to figure out what's going on. I mean,
well, they're so weird. They just don't look like anything else in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, with an actual boss, with Blank Man, you know, I mean, they all have different patterns, but really you can reduce a lot of Mega Man bosses down into 3 or 4 basic attack patterns. In fact, I was playing Solar Man this morning, mm-hmm. and realized that he moves and attacks almost exactly like Pharaoh Man from Mega Man 4.
Hmm.
So there are really very few truly unique Mega Man bosses. I mean, you got stuff like Pump Man and Sheep Man. They're really not that much different from other Mega Man bosses. And a lot of times the weapons fall into the same old trends of, well, this one's like a 3-way shot, and this is kind of a rolling thing that follows the walls as after you shoot it out. So it's all very pattern based, but it's not only not a bad thing, but it's actually kind of comforting. And that's the great thing about Mega Man, is that, you know, it is so nostalgic, it's so familiar for people who've been playing it for a long time, that it just seems to take off these boxes, and as long as it does it well, you know, as long as it's not thrown together like freaking Mega Man X6, which is trash. Mm-hmm. You know, as long as the levels are actually well done, it's okay if they're pretty derivative. Because they do always throw in these little teeny things that are different, that are basically fan service. And I can appreciate that because I'm a fan. So $10, extremely well spent so far.
I'm trying to remember which game was 6 in my... Oh, never mind.
Mega Man X6 is... I'll put it this way. If you own the collection on GameCube or PS2, I recommend that you just don't even play Mega Man X6. It's that bad.
I own it twice. But yeah. Anyway.
that's really a shame. Do you have it on PS1 or what?
I do, yeah. And I have it on the collection.
I do really, really hope, though. I mean, these Mega Man revivals have been so good, and I really hope that Capcom will eventually try to do a Mega Man X revival. Because I guess that would be Mega Man X9, I want to say. I think 8 was the last one on PS2.
I think they disavowed 7, though.
Well, 7 and 8 are both not... I heard that 8 is actually better than 7.
7 was 3D. 7 gave us Bamboo Pandemonium.
Yeah, and then 8, Mega Man X8 is kind of like 2.5D, so it plays more like the older Mega Man X's, but it has 3D graphics.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure, and I think it has like 3 playable characters. Anyway.
Yeah.
This is really a tangent at this point, but I would love to see Innis Creates or, you know, whatever studio Capcom picks out. I would love to see someone go back to that series and really capture, because I feel like the first 3 Mega Man X's are... They're some of my favorite action games ever.
I'll even throw up the 4 in there, because 4 had the second character playability stuff in there.
Yeah, 4 is very good. It's not as good as 3 especially. I think 3 is spectacular.
The one difference for those who are uninitiated between these games is that the X games tend to be harder.
Maybe.
Well, if when X1 came out, it was way harder than where the regular Mega Man series was at that point.
I agree with that, yeah.
It was
because Mega Man
harder.
X came out about the same time as Mega Man 6.
Something like
Mega
that,
Mega Man
yeah.
5 or 6. It was around then.
And it was just ass-beating hard.
Yeah, there's no comparison. But the other thing is, I think in Mega Man X, you learn to use the new mechanics of the game. Things like dashing and grabbing onto walls. I think sub-tanks are almost cheating at some point. I mean, they're so good. And there is a little bit of grinding sometimes to fill them back up. But the fact that you can have your life bar can be half empty, you can use a sub tank and it'll just fill up until your bar's done, and then it'll reserve the rest for you to use later.
Yes.
I mean, that's sophisticated on a level that you're not going to get in any Mega Man game. I mean, the only thing that even comes close to it is the weapon balancer, and that didn't even appear until, I think, Mega Man 6.
Also, the X games introduced us to the Mega Man butt rock, which, honestly, added a whole new dimension to the series.
I do kind of prefer the music in the NES series, and 9 and 10. You know, I just prefer that style, but...
I just really always enjoyed watching, like, the cinematics in the X games and just laughing my ass off.
All right. Well, that's enough talk of Mega Man 10. It will come up again a lot in newscast, I'm sure, next week. So the other thing I've been playing for the past 2 or 3 days is Brutal Legend. I rented it on Xbox 360, and this is the Tim Schafer Double Fine Jack Black game. It's a game that I wasn't really all that excited about until I played the demo last fall. And the demo, I was surprisingly funny and surprisingly fun for me. You know, I heard all the warnings that, well, the game kind of changes a couple hours in and it becomes a lot of real-time strategy. That's not really much of a deterrent for me because I actually like real-time strategy. I haven't played one in a while, but I'm very excited about StarCraft II, for instance. So the concept of this turning into a real-time strategy is not necessarily a bad thing for me. The bad thing for me is the whole heavy metal thing, which doesn't really appeal to me at all. I'm not a heavy metal fan. I never have been. And Jack Black, who I really can't stand most of the time. I think he's actually... I recently caught up with High Fidelity. I think he's actually very good in that.
Yeah.
But everything since then seems to just be like an imitation of that character, except more annoying.
I thought he was pretty good in King Kong. I liked him in that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. I kind of don't like that movie in general. But yeah, I guess he was pretty good in that.
He's not playing that character in that movie.
Exactly. Yeah. It's different.
True. I think he's completely obnoxious in Tropic Thunder, and not in a funny way. But anyway, the nice thing is, first off, the heavy metal, the music part of it is, you know, I mean, the soundtrack is all heavy metal, but it's generally curated well, I think, and it's pretty easy to turn that off because it mostly exists in music while you're driving around in your weird car. So you can actually turn off the radio in that if you don't want to hear it. And I haven't even bothered to do that because I think the heavy metal they picked out is pretty, I don't know about tasteful, but it's not like It doesn't feel like your ears are going to bleed, or it's not just people like screaming at you the whole time. It tends to be more in the vein of like the 70s and the 80s kind of metal.
Mm-hmm. And I know there's some pretty obscure metal on there too.
I'm sure there is. I wouldn't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I recognize a couple of the names like Motorhead, or they actually had a Def Leppard song, which is pretty light as far as metal goes. That's pretty mainstream stuff. Mm-hmm. And Jack Black, I actually think his voice acting is very, very good. And I think it's actually probably one of the better roles that he's played in the past 10 years, probably. I mean, I'm not joking there. I think he's actually very good in the game. So, aesthetically, it's actually proven to be really charming. I feel like the world of Brutal Legend, I'm not really sure what the world is supposed to be called, but it's so ridiculous, but actually surprisingly charming in the way it looks. I mean, it's this big countryside. It's kind of like Hyrule Field or something. It's very open world. You just kind of drive around wherever you want to and look for little secrets all over the place. But it seems like all the decoration in the environment, you know, all the little outcroppings of rock or the little statues or whatever, everything seems like it's made of amplifiers or tusks or scrap metal or car parts. And it's so silly. It's so silly, but it's not as ugly as I would have thought. Actually, I feel like the game actually kind of has this warmth to it, and maybe it's the not-so-subtle cartoony nature of the art style, you know? I mean, the characters certainly look very cartoony, and I think it extends to the world as well, because, you know, if you told me that, well, it's set in this world full of lava and metal, you know, I would think, wow, that sounds bad. I mean, it just doesn't sound very visually appealing, but for some reason, the world they create is actually quite interesting and fun to drive around in, and fun to look at, and I'm surprised. And that's so far as my favorite part of the game. You know, I do generally like these big open worlds where you can drive around and there's neat stuff to find, and so that's been my favorite part. I think the combat is just okay, and definitely the beginning of the game is mostly third-person action stuff. You're swinging your axe and playing your guitar to shock people, and it's just okay. It's simple, but it works. I think if the whole game was like that, you'd probably get sick of it. And then I'm right now just on the cusp of getting into some of the real-time strategy parts, which it starts off, it feels like it's kind of easing you into it gradually, and then all of a sudden it throws you way in the deep end, and you're defending resource pools and calling in new units. It's like it goes from having a couple guys that you're escorting around to all of a sudden you're building armies and defending a base. So it makes a pretty big leap there. And, you know, I haven't played enough of the strategy parts to say that I agree or disagree with a lot of people's, you know, angst about that part of the game. But I do kind of get the sense that if the strategy parts become more complex and more difficult, the controls for them might be kind of frustrating, because it's a console game. But it does feel like you don't really have all that great of an interface for managing your army. I mean, there's stuff like to call your entire army to you, you actually have to pull out your guitar and play this little mini game guitar solo just to get everybody to come there. Whereas on the computer, you would press a button or click somewhere on the screen. So it just feels like things take longer. It's not real clear which guys are following you and at your command and which guys are just kind of off on their own doing whatever, you know, fighting the nearest bad guy. So, I mean, it actually kind of makes me appreciate Pikmin, because Pikmin is less ambitious in terms of scale in a lot of ways, but you do know, you know, where your troops are in Pikmin, and you know how to get to the ones you want, and you know how to keep up with them. You know how to manage the battlefield. And so far in Brutal Legend, I feel like it's all a bit chaotic, and I don't really have the tools to really keep up with everything and to do what I want to do with the army. But we'll see. We'll see. I'm just getting to that point. So one last thing in my new business, I wanted to give a little bit of a tease here, because I went to GameStop today and picked up, actually I got it at Best Buy. I picked up a game that I think will be interesting to talk about over the next couple of weeks. It's something that James will probably cry when he hears me mention it. But after listening to Andy Gergen's talk on the recent newscast and reading his review, and hearing the podcast on Active Time Babble where they talked about roguelikes.
You didn't!
I picked up the DS version of Shiren the Wanderer.
Oh my god.
It was only $15. Oh. So.
$15 poorly spent, dumbass.
You could have given that to a homeless person.
Maybe so.
You could have burned it.
You know, Andy seemed to think there was something worthwhile in this.
He's wrong.
And I was actually, I was intrigued. They did a whole podcast on Active Time Babble about this kind of game. And
yeah.
It sounds very imposing. But at the same time, there were parts of it that really intrigued me. And I thought, well, maybe I'll like it. I won't know until I try it. And Jeremy Parrish, you know, one of the other people on the show asked him, well, where would you recommend people start? And he said the DS version of Shiren the Wanderer. Mm-hmm. So I went out and found a cheap copy of it, and I'm going to give it a try. We'll see. I may hate it completely. I probably will.
It sounds like it's kind of a crackhead with a heart of gold.
Hey, I mean, you know, I spent $10 on Super Ghouls and Ghosts, so this can't be that much worse of a proposition.
True.
Oh, it's a different kind of thing. But I think they're up to Shiren 4 on DS in Japan, which got a really good reception, apparently.
Well, you know, when you don't have to design levels, you save a lot of money in development.
They can just keep cranking them out.
But anyway... I haven't started it yet. I just thought I would tease it and look for my agony on an upcoming episode.
Well, to be fair, the description I've gotten for that game is that it doesn't force you to play like 55 floors in a row. It's more like 10.
Right. And I do think, from what I heard, it's actually probably better balanced than the Pokemon Mystery Dungeons. I mean, it's probably not as piss easy, so it's actually more interesting. I mean, we'll see. That was the impression I got. I'm trusting Jeremy Parrish here. We'll see how it works out. Anyway, John, you're up next.
All right. Yeah, nothing Nintendo this week, but one game I did kind of pick up at Best Buy. They had it on sale for $20. Was Raiden 4 Shoot 'Em Up by really a couple of. I mean, it's. I think the company that made it is called Moss, M-O-S-S. I've never heard of them. Some obscure Japanese development house.
Moss Limited,
by
the way.
Yeah, really, really liking it so far. It's just a very straightforward. I mean, anybody that's played the Raiden games, I mean, it's very a straightforward vertical shooter. There's really not a whole lot to it, but that's kind of what I like about it. It almost seems like the shoot 'em up genre overall. It just seems like it's been done to death so much that every single shoot 'em up that comes out has to be more complex than the last.
Yeah.
But this one's not like that.
And that's how Bullet Hell came into being.
Yeah, and this one is Bullet Hell, but you know, it's the thing is it's not
like total Bullet Hell.
No, it's not. It's you kind of feel like you can develop enough skill to actually compensate for the bullet hellishness. Whereas many other shoot 'em ups that come out these days, you play it for about 10 minutes and you're like, wow, there's really no way that I could ever become competent at this unless I devoted my life to it. And fortunately, Raiden 4 is not like that. And I mean, it has all of the kind of, it's, I think it's an Xbox 360 exclusive, and it has all of like the, you know, kind of Xbox Live trappings. I don't think you can play co-op online. I know there is a co-op because, you know, you can play two players at once, but I don't believe you can do that over Xbox Live. I'm not really sure. Lord knows I don't know anybody else that owns this game unless James, do you own it?
I've played it, but I don't own it.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty funny because when you look at the online high score table, there's about 2,500 scores worldwide. So
total,
it just gives
you
an idea of how niche this game is. It's very, let's just say it's a cult classic, if you will.
John, did you ever play Gradius 5? I know you own it.
Yeah, I did, actually.
Okay. Did you like that one?
Oh, yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. And Gradius tends to be less bullet hellish than.
Yeah, it's
some
more
other
traditional.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I haven't really played a proper bullet hell game. I mean, I wouldn't really count Ikaruga because it's a bit different.
Yeah.
But I think that's the closest I would have played. But they've never appealed to me at all, even being a big fan of shoot 'em ups. I'm not interested in that.
Yeah.
The last one I played was Castle of Shikigami on Wii.
Yeah.
Total bullet hell, and completely just turned me off after a while. I'm just like, this is just ridiculous. I mean,
yeah, there's a kind of line of demarcation I have where I basically grew up playing these games, so I think I'm competent at them, but there's a point where I'm just like, no, there are 4,000 shots on the screen right now.
Uh-huh.
I can't deal with this.
Yeah, it reminds me of the equivalent of the kind of Dragon Force guitar wankery of like, you know, let's just do this because, you know, in the old days you couldn't have populated the screen with insane amounts of bullets because you couldn't run it. It wouldn't have been able to handle it. So it's like, oh, we could do this now, so let's do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, just because you can go to ridiculous excess doesn't make it a good game design.
Yeah, I mean, most of those smaller games, they kind of remind me of, you know, the roguelike genre in a way, because I'm sure you have people out there who sit there who, you know, live like monks and all they do is play shoot 'em ups all day, and, you know, they develop insane skills at bullet hell shoot 'em ups, but they're such a small audience.
There's a lot of memorization in that kind of a game.
Oh,
once
yeah.
you have that many shots on the screen, and I generally don't go for memorization. I mean, you know, some people accuse like Mega Man games of requiring memorization. I think that's could not be farther from the truth.
Yeah.
I think Mega Man games, it helps if you've played it before and you remember where certain things are going to happen, but you can absolutely get to the boss the first life if you're good. If you have the reflexes and you pay attention, you can absolutely do it.
It's more determined on have you learned the skills to beat Mega Man games.
And a lot of people don't bother.
Yeah.
Or they just never had the opportunity.
It's a fine line, I think. I mean, there are times where you could, if you had really good reflexes or you were being really conservative, avoid something, but chances are it's going to be by experience.
Yeah.
I can remember there's certain bits of Mega Man 3 where you're dropping down pits, you know, for a couple screens, and then all of a sudden the next screen is this spikes at the bottom. You know, I mean, that
yeah, I know. Yeah.
You could react to that, maybe, but chances are you're just going to hit the floor and die that one time.
The trick on those is you just don't go, hey, I'm going down. It's that you slide
down.
Oh,
I know what you mean, but the first time you do it, you're not necessarily sure. Like, you know, for instance, like, it would help to know whether you should be towards the left-hand side or the right-hand side. Like, where's the safe bit of floor going to be? But I don't really have a problem with that in general. I just think as long as there's not too much of that, you know, there's got, it's always balanced. And I'm quite happy to play games that you will get much better at by experience, but I think definitely if it becomes too intricate, like, you know, okay, remember, you know, stand in this spot and then that spot and then that spot, then you've got a problem. It's better if it's like a broader kind
of
pattern.
Yeah, and that's what most shoot 'em ups these days demand, at least the really, really hardcore ones. The other game that I've been playing just a little bit, I actually kind of bought it just to support game development here in the state of Georgia, which is trying to kind of get off the...
Are you shitting me?
No. I'm not sure.
That's why you bought the game, really?
Not entirely, but it's partially why. I mean, the game is good,
wow,
and I'm interested in it, but also the fact that there's so few game development houses here in the state, and this is actually a very credible game that's created by somebody here. So, Global Agenda. It's a third-person shooter with kind of RPG trappings. Like, you can level your character, you can craft armor, craft guns and stuff like that. And the cool thing about it, and kind of speaks to a concern with MMOs in general that Johnny has, is the subscription issue. You know, Johnny has long said that one of the things he doesn't like about MMOs is the fact that you have to pay each month.
I'm not opposed in principle. I feel like you don't really get what you pay for.
Yeah.
Just to clarify there, my stance on that.
Yeah, and of course, you know, I disagree completely, but but the thing is, that's completely a valid complaint. Most people just want to buy a game once and that's it, and that makes perfect sense. But the good thing about this particular game, this particular MMO, is the fact that you can do all of the death matching, character leveling, kind of like PvE sort of stuff without paying a dime. You just buy the game and you can do all of that. The stuff that you actually have to pay for is kind of the more, if they call it conquest, and what it is you basically, your guild, in this case, they call it something else, but it's a guild for all intents and purposes. You can take over territory. It's on a hex-based map, and you can have 60 up to 60 player death matches taking over different objectives, and you know try to capture territory and stuff like that. And if you want to get into that kind of competitive aspect of the game, that's what you have to subscribe for. But you can still play it just like you would, say, Modern Warfare 2 or something like that, and you don't have to subscribe whatsoever.
That sounds like an interesting proposition. I guess, like, again, I would say that if that's the only thing you get for paying the subscription, it doesn't sound to me like it's worth it, but I haven't actually played the game, so.
But, I mean, that seems like it's the big thing that actually makes the game what it is versus just a shooter.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, because there's all kinds of shooters out there. But the thing is, the reason why I think this is interesting is because I think this is probably the direction that Activision is going to take. And I think just shooters in general, I think this is what they're going to do with something like Modern Warfare 2, where you will probably go out and, even for consoles, where you'll probably go out and buy the game and you'll be able to do everything that you can do in Modern Warfare 2 right now. Like, you can build your character up sort of RPG style, and you can do deathmatch, team deathmatch, all that kind of stuff. But then if you want to get into this territorial combat, this kind of meta game almost, that's what you'll probably have to pay money for. So I think it's interesting. I mean, I don't think that this game is going to get the critical mass like something with a huge brand like Modern Warfare 2 would, but I still think that it's kind of the shape of things to come in terms of shooters.
It makes sense because probably a small percentage of Call of Duty players would be interested in paying for something like that, but mm-hmm. the group that will get really into it, and it could keep them playing for months, so they'll end up paying for it until the next game comes out.
Mm-hmm.
So basically it's a way for Activision to, or for any company, to get the most amount of money possible out of their biggest fans who are going to use the game to the fullest yeah. extent, whereas everybody else doesn't really get punished for it.
I guess you look at the people that probably just, you know, the play the existing online options as much as they do. I'm sure Activision, a company like that, is looking at that and saying, these people are willing to pay more for this game.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. We just have to facilitate that. And obviously, you know, you're not going to do it by making the retail price more expensive because that affects everyone.
Isn't that funny? Because, like, and I guess the Star Trek Online experimented with this a bit, but think about when World of Warcraft first came out, how many people would have paid $100 to play it for free forever? I'm thinking not that many.
But see, now it's not a smart proposition on their part. It's kind
right.
of like, see, I feel like maybe all MMOs should launch like that because you have to build that critical base that sticks around for a while. Otherwise, the entire franchise is in jeopardy, essentially.
Mm-hmm. My belief is, and I think I've mentioned this before, but if the game can only be played by subscription, like a true MMO, then the base, the disc, should be free.
Oh, there's no question.
Yeah.
But because we're not
you can't
get there.
If you stop paying this. Actually, what I like about this global agenda that John is mentioning is that if you know if your subscription runs out or you can't afford it anymore, at least you can still play the game.
Yeah, and a lot of the game, not just like one little nerfed little
right.
bit of it.
Yeah, I mean, I like that approach. I think it's fine.
What I don't like, and I don't think this game does it, but there have been games that have in the past that experimented with this pay for optional content model, is that it creates like a caste system where people who don't pay get annihilated. People who do pay can prey on them with infinite, basically divine power.
Mm-hmm.
Planetscape actually did something like that with an add-on where basically if you got the add-on, you got this weapon that essentially made you invincible to people who didn't get the add-on.
Yeah. I mean, that's just poor game design, really. I mean, they shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't poor game design. They did it intentionally. They wanted to force you to go buy the fucking add-on.
It's probably poor marketing in that case. Exactly. It didn't work.
It did exactly what they designed it to do.
But yeah, the one cool story that I have to bring up, though, is when I actually did buy the game, I ordered it off of Amazon, and it was – and UPS supposedly brought it to my apartment door. Now, it said that it was left on my quote-unquote porch. Now, what that actually means, what I interpret that to mean is that they left it out in the hallway of my apartment complex. So anybody could literally come by, see that there's an Amazon package in front of my door, and pick it up and scoop it.
Yeah, basically.
That hasn't happened up to this point, but I think it might have happened with this package because it didn't get brought to the office and it didn't show up at my door. And my wife was home during the day when it was supposedly brought to my porch. And I never got it. So what was cool was that, you know, I decided to, instead of going to UPS, because going to UPS is usually a complete debacle, I yep. decided to try to resolve it through Amazon. And Amazon basically patched me through directly to High Res, which are the guys that make it. Now, their office is about 4 miles away from where I work. It's about a 10-minute drive away. So knowing this, I was actually talking to somebody directly from their office, and I said, well, this may sound kind of weird. I don't want to be kind of creepy, but if you want, instead of shipping me, because they said, we'll absolutely ship you out a replacement game, no problem. They were really cool about it. And I said, well, instead of you paying money to ship it, why don't I just come by your office and pick it up? And so sure enough, they said, sure, come on by. And so I went over there about 7 o'clock at night, and they had their support.
7 o'clock at night?
Yeah, and they had their support crew on there because, you know, they have probably support there at all times of the night. And
yeah.
Sure enough, they just gave me a new copy of the game, and they gave me a T-shirt to go along with it. And I was like, cool, thank you, High Res Studios. Good
wow.
job.
See, this is why you buy local, Jolly.
Yeah.
You poo-pooed the idea earlier.
Exactly.
Now, James, I know you've been looking for a cure to your RPG addiction.
It's not working.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in the backlog I created for myself, which in all my infinite wisdom, essentially at one point spanned like 4 or 5 games.
It's child's play.
Except I actually play the games I buy.
Touche.
I actually reached the end, which is Dragon Age Origins, which I think I put it this way. It's pretty clear that BioWare's A-Team was on Mass Effect 2 when they were making Dragon Age Origins. Because This game doesn't feel nearly as polished as even the first Mass Effect game. Mm-hmm. It's much more rooted in previous games that have come before it.
I'm not surprised, because Dragon Age seems like a much more niche kind of product than Mass Effect.
As I put it to a friend of mine who adores this game, it's like Fable 2 with a party full of dumbasses. Because your party has the innate ability to get itself killed, even in the least precarious situations.
Now, James, have you played Baldur's Gate?
Yes.
Okay.
What I don't understand about this, I mean, it's not a bad game. Let me make that clear. It's not a bad game, but it's not an amazing, completely stunning title, because there's not a lot of originality in it, to be honest. There's a lot of original writing, but it feels like they ripped off pretty much every fantasy author that's ever walked the face of the earth writing this thing.
Don't tell me there's an evil lord that betrayed you.
Oh.
And you have
there's two. There's two of them, John.
There's a tower with an evil wizard in it.
Yep, did that already.
Yeah, you beat that quest, right?
I already beat that song, bitch.
Actually, James, I have a question for you about Dragon Age.
Yeah.
Actually, I too had some friends who were playing this in the fall and were so crazy over it and kept recommending it to me. And it seems like the kind of thing that would be so intimidating for someone who doesn't play a lot of American-style RPGs, basically, or Western RPGs. I mean, even the first Mass Effect took me a while to convince myself that I should try it. And luckily, that was a very simple version of that genre.
Yeah.
And I think Mass Effect 2 is even less so, although I haven't really started it.
Mass Effect 2 is apparently closer to a third-person shooter.
Right. But Dragon Age, it just seems like, I don't know, my mental image of that game is just nested menus.
Yeah,
and
a little bit.
An hour-long character creation, which is such a turnoff. You might as well give me a two-hour tutorial. I'd rather do that than an hour-long character creation.
I created my character in about 10, 15 minutes, and despite my best efforts, he looks horrifying. he looks like he has a birth defect, which is depressing, because every time you look at his dead behind-the-eyes face, you think, man, you are a hideous dude.
And you can still have sex with all your party members, right?
I haven't broached that yet, but I'm pretty sure with this face, no.
But I mean, in the game, that's one of the things about Dragon Age, right? Is that you can pretty much just hook up with everybody.
I guess. Most of my party members either don't like me or are ambivalent to me.
That doesn't mean they won't have sex with you.
That's right. Just get them drunk, maybe, you know?
Tell them the world's going to end the next day.
That's right.
Already did that quest, too. We're good.
Oh, okay.
But the thing about this game that it is really closer to the Western-style RPG, because there's, you know, I think it's 7 or 8 different stats that you have to level up individually. There's skills, and then there's also, I can't remember what they call it, but it's like a whole other set of like passive talents that you can enhance with leveling up. It's really tedious, I'll be honest. But what pisses me off about the game is that there's almost no skill in the combat at all.
Well, it's an RPG. I mean, that's not
usual. Well, if you compare it to, like, Mass Effect, where there is maybe some skill involved in the combat.
Sure. Mass Effect's part shooter, so...
Yeah, if you hold... Yeah. Basically, the combat amounted to hold down A, hope your party doesn't get itself killed.
Mm-hmm. So it's all stat building and stuff.
Yeah, they usually let you down anyway and get themselves killed. But it does seem like they have the ability to just run right into the face of danger and be like, hey, kill me.
Someone's probably going to email us and tell us that you're playing the game wrong.
That's fine. But that's the game like I want to play the game. And the game still shouldn't have your characters identify there's a booby trap on the ground and then proceed to run right through it.
Now, can you set up like the AI of your party characters?
Some, but I don't think it's going to fix the fact they're stupid.
John, this isn't Final Fantasy XII.
Hey, I'm grabbing at straws.
I mean, the game, obviously, there was a lot of effort put into it. It's got good things going for it. It's long as hell, but it's pretty derivative. And the combat's a little bit dry. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of quests you can do. But I don't see myself giving this the second or third playthrough that a lot of people gave it to try out the different races and classes. Because, honestly, I don't care that much. Yeah. I'm more likely to go back to, God help me, another RPG that I can actually get through without having to deal with 100 stats and watching my party flail around.
Which RPG do you think is next on the plate?
I don't know, honestly. At this point, I would take another Tales game over this.
Well, what's funny is, I mean, it sounds more like, and this just really doesn't surprise me coming from them, but it sounds more like an MMO that, I mean, because MMOs are like stats out
it
the
is.
Ass.
It,
you know?
It's like,
I mean,
it's like an MMO with 3 dumbass party people who lost their mics.
James, it always seems like you play these games where characters just do stupid
things. I just think that there are a lot of stupid character designs out there. Just people who just do dumb things. I mean, They did dumb things in Mass Effect too, but generally speaking, you could survive their stupidity.
Yeah. Do you mean Mass Effect also,
or Mass Effect? Yes, Mass Effect also.
Okay. Yeah. Because I don't think any of us have actually played Mass Effect 2.
No,
right?
because my $50 game rules or $60 game rules still in effect.
I right. bought it.
I own it. I own it. I've put it in, but I saved about 5 minutes into it.
I put it in, and then immediately took it out.
Actually, I also got Dragon Age for Christmas, but I haven't even installed that.
Of course.
So, John, you got it for PC?
Yeah, I got it for PC.
Sounds like that's the way to go.
Yeah, with those particular games, I typically get them for PC just because they always, I mean, at some point I will have a better graphics card than I do now, and I'll probably take advantage of those games.
Supposedly, the performance and controls are significantly better on PC.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I would have gotten it on a PC, except this old guy's not, you know, top the line like he used to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I can't really use it on the big TV either.
Is there not a netbook mode in Dragon Age?
No, I don't think there's a netbook mode in Dragon Age. I think when you walked into the first city, the netbook would go nuclear and just explode. Mm-hmm. One thing about the game that I do really like is that it's not go to A, go to B, go to C. You can basically just pick these quests out, including the story quest, however you want to do them. And in that way, I don't think anybody here played Fable.
I've played Fable 2. I haven't played the first one.
You play Fable 2? That's even better. That's an even better example. The quests
it's
are
an
presented,
even better game. It's really good.
The quests are presented exactly like Fable 2, including the story quests. Like, they might have ripped off the menus.
That's right. You do choose quests from a menu in Fable, don't you?
That's pretty much this game, except you don't have to traverse the overworld on foot. You just say, I want to go to the city. And then
maybe
you
the
there.
New Zelda will be that way, too.
Oh, you'd be thrilled, wouldn't you? Hey, a Zelda with no exploration. Enjoy.
I would not mind if the new Zelda learned a couple things from Fable 2, put it that way. All right, Greg, please wrap up new business.
Yeah, well, first of all, Mega Man 10 came out here just a few hours ago as we record, so I'll be downloading that.
Good.
I really enjoyed 9. It was very, very good. Then I went back and played 2 and 3, which I enjoyed as well, so I'm really looking forward to that, even though the nostalgia factor isn't there for me. The excellence is there, which, similarly, I finished off Bionic Commando Rearmed this week, which I was completely inept at. It was really I mean, because the thing is, the way it's set up on normal is you have infinite lives, and it kind of respawns you if you just fall into a pit or spikes or whatever. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's pretty forgiving. And again, what tended to happen then is I just kind of just bungled my way through a lot of different stuff, which, it's difficult to say what would have happened if you were playing it in the more kind of traditional NES style, or, you know, what you've got with the hard mode where you've got limited lives and stuff, because I could have become frustrated with it and perhaps not wanted to persist, but then on the other hand, yeah, maybe it would actually force me to get better at manipulating the grappling hook and all, because it gives you the tutorial to start with, which is, you know, goes through quite a lot of your fairly advanced techniques if you want to go through that, in terms, you know, of like hooking onto the sides of ledges and then like swinging back the other way and stuff. So it certainly prepares you for it, but I still just couldn't do it very well. I wasn't very good at it.
I think there's a lot of sheer practice and repetition, because that grappling hook is not something that you can tell someone how to use. There's a lot of finesse to it. And a lot of times it comes down to like the pixel that attaches. I mean, it's extremely detailed. It matters exactly.
Well, there's also little things like, you know, like, okay, so you might want to hold up to shoot the grapple straight up rather than on a diagonal. But if you continue to hold up, he'll start to climb up the platform, which sometimes you may not want to do. So it's like those little fine things of like, okay, well, I'll hold up now, but then I need to let go. And then, you know, these sorts of little things is what I seem to struggle with a lot of the time.
Yeah.
That was tough going at times, but it was still really enjoyable. I mean, I was quite surprised by like some of the variety with the weapons. Mm-hmm. I was quite impressed with. I really enjoyed the bosses a lot. Obviously, they start repeating a bit later
They're
on.
They're great, though.
There's really great ideas in there, sort of slightly puzzle-based, I guess, in a way. So all of that stuff was just... I still find myself really entertained. I guess one day, perhaps I should try the hard mode and see if I can actually develop my skills. So obviously, I got somewhat better, but I just never felt like I really, nailed it.
One thing you might try first, actually, Greg, is to go in the challenge mode and do some of the challenges.
Yeah, there's all those VR room kind of type things.
And they start off manageable, and they get absolutely evil later on. I mean, it is much, much harder than anything you will do in the main game if you want to go for that. I mean, I do think it's actually a good training ground to just learn how the controls work because, it's time-based, so you kind of want to be quick but accurate at the same time, and they're just laid out very mechanically, so they kind of just introduce you to one thing at a time.
Yeah, but I mean, in some ways, it's almost like the flip side of the Ghouls and Ghosts situation, where you've got a sort of an orthodox way of getting around that I found it really difficult to deal with, whereas with Ghouls and Ghosts, I grew up with that, so I've always kind of instinctively understood it. Whereas, if I'd been coming back to this having played it on the NES, for instance, I probably would have been able to discover the old magic.
Though, it takes a lot of technique, though. I mean, you got to learn.
This is more involved than the Ghouls and Ghosts.
They ask you to do a lot of crazy stuff grappling-wise, like in terms of attaching to platforms properly. Like timing wise?
I mean, one thing I kind of used quite a lot after a while playing conservatively was the ability to come to a stop and then use the shotgun to get yourself swinging again.
Mm-hmm. That is an awesome technique. I love that.
That is really cool and really useful if you're kind of crap at it.
Well, and when you get to the challenges, there are actually certain places where that's the only way to do it.
Yeah, I can imagine there would be, but how it was useful for me was like, okay, I'm not going to do this in three perfect swings, but I can kind of, use this to kind of fudge it a bit. And it is a really cool idea. I just thought it was great. And I also like the bit where you have to interrogate the prisoner of war by hitting him in the face with the crowbar. It's like, I will tell you nothing, bang, bang, bang. All right, I'll cough it.
That would be pretty terrifying, Yeah. See that claw coming at your face.
His head would probably just come off straight away. Must have like a softly moan on that arm somewhere.
I mean, I would love to get a sequel to Rearmed, because Rearmed is basically mostly a remake of the first Bionic Commando. They certainly added some new levels and some new ideas, but it's for the most part a remake. And I would love to see them just do a whole other... Of course, the guys who made it...
They're gone.
Yeah, they're gone.
But I'm sure that, those designers are around. I think they already started a new studio. I would love to see Capcom go after that again. And actually, I was just thinking... it's been a while since we had a good Spider-Man game. It'd be really cool to have like playable Dr. Octopus using some of the mechanics from Bionic Commando, because he would presumably control it similarly in some respects, except I would think he'd also be able to climb walls and stuff like that. But Doc Ock's little mechanical arms are basically the grappling hook from Bionic Commando.
Well, especially when you start grabbing people with it and like kind of using them as humans. So that's very Dr. Octopus.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of overlap there, so... I don't know, it just popped into my head.
I really enjoyed that. It's something I've been looking forward to for quite a while. I finally got around to it, and it is great. And then on the DS travels, I picked up for cheap Bleach Dark Souls, which is the second of the Treasure-developed fighting games for the DS. Actually, I think it only came out a year ago in Europe. Because of the whole, timelines with the anime, I guess.
Do you watch Bleach?
No, I have not really watched it. I'm sort of casually familiar with it. Pretty much my interest in this has always been a matter of the fact that it's Treasure and it's got pretty good reviews. I remember Carl reviewed the first one for DS. One of the last reviews I think he did for us was Blade of Fate when that came out in America, and he gave it an 8.5. He liked it. And this is apparently much the same, but just with some refinements and more characters and stuff. I mean, first of all, the graphics are quite impressive for a DS game. I think you've got like nice, pretty big chunky sprites. They're still quite well animated. I mean, I guess they emulate the look of the show pretty well. that you've got like a sort of dynamic kind of camera thing that you've probably seen in, you know, quite a few other fighting games that works quite well. You could go, you know, four players. You've got what download play, which I actually helped me buy the game because a friend of mine has got this and we played a bit of download play and I thought, oh, you know, it kind of reminded me that it was, you know, that it had got good reviews and that it might be worth playing if I could find it for a reasonable price, which I then did. So nice. It is worth putting in, although it took ages to actually do the, you know, the communication part. For whatever reason, one of the longest I've ever had to wait for one of those to load. But I guess it is quite complicated, like I said, because the special attacks are actually quite surprisingly spectacular. It's not like Tatsunoko versus Capcom, but there's some pretty, you know, it's an anime game, so it's not surprising really. But, you know, you've got like giant human-faced caterpillars coming along, destroying everyone on the screen and stuff. Yeah, it handles the action at a pretty good pace. It seems to me that you know, they've got a good air fighting engine going on with it. And in terms of some of the content, the story mode, you know, it's not like brilliant or anything. But the one thing I would say for it is that you are taken through like these bunch of different kind of tasks. Some of them are just about, you know, beating someone. One or other ones will be, you know, different sort of things like having to beat three people at precisely the same time or collecting stuff, like sort of utilizing the fact that you kind of switch between two planes, which it does in this and things like that. So it kind of introduces you to all the different elements of the battle mechanics, and so in a way helps teach you, you know, what the game is about, which is not something that even like all modern fighting games do. And I certainly appreciate it not being the most like dedicated fighting game fan. I think it's a good thing to have in one player content.
And are you playing this Bleach game primarily as a single player? I mean, it's a
fighting
game.
No, I mean, I have played it somewhat on the train just to kind of like unlock stuff and just get acclimated to it. But yeah, I mean, like I said, a friend of mine's got the game, so I ended up getting yourself, and that's how I play it primarily, is to play it against him. And it's got online as well, which I haven't really been able to try out very much. I assume there isn't really much in the way of people playing it, probably, in terms of random battles and all that. But apparently that is certainly from the reviews at the time, that's meant to hold up pretty well for a fighting game online, which is always a bit dicey, as we know.
Right. Anything on DS online is dicey.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, I suppose one of the other things is that I do like the fact you've got like lots of unlockables as you kind of get with these big kind of character fighting games. But you actually do get rewarded with in-game currency just for playing two-player, you know, multi-card. Nice. Which is not something, for instance, that you get in Tatsunoko versus Capcom, just playing the two of you. And so I think the only way you can get those kinds of currency is either by playing the arcade mode or like playing the mini games in the Japanese version, which got largely taken out, I think, for the American one. So again, if you're going to have all this unlockables and like in-game currency, just reward people for playing it. You know, you may as well, you know, it's mostly kind of trivial stuff. It's not a big deal. But it just makes sense to me to try and encourage you to play with someone else as much as you can, which is definitely one of the sort of problems I have with Tatsunoko. It just seems like all it wants to encourage you to do is play through that damn arcade mode a million times.
14 times. I still haven't unlocked everything. I haven't been able to make myself go through it enough times to get everything in Tatsunoko.
Yeah, which is a shame because there's a lot of cool unlockables in that game. Mm-hmm. And I think even more in the American version.
Right. Okie doke. Well, that's the end of new business. Now we're going to take a break. When we come back, we have a whole lot of listener mail. Listener mail! Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. This week on the website, Aaron went to the Nintendo Media Summit, of course, and he is now catching up with all of his game impressions, including write-ups on Super Mario Galaxy 2, Metroid Other M, Nintendo DSi XL, Picross 3D, Art Style Rotozoa, and many more.
Aaron also captured a bunch of direct feed footage, also hands-on video. You got a lot of great video of titles like Monster Hunter Tri, Super Meat Boy, Max and the Magic Marker, and Sin and Punishment 2, so be sure to check those out.
He also had that whole article on Chris Kohler.
Yes, he did.
That's some funny stuff. There's a lot of Photo Dojo stuff there. He basically filmed Chris playing Photo Dojo and doing all the photos for it. It's really funny.
Let's see. Previews. Pedro, he gives us a preview of Super Mario Galaxy 2.
So can we call that the review of Super Mario Galaxy 1?
Hey-o! Nice. And Neil also gives us the lowdown on the upcoming WiiWare title, Rage of the Gladiator.
So Andy takes his turn with the eternal mistake by reviewing Sheer and the Wanderer, which is a roguelike, and he found it to be predictably frustrating that relies on trial and error, which should appeal to the no fans of this genre.
To the five fans.
Who will now write us because I just said there's no fans and they hate us. We also have some interviews where we talk, singular actually, we have an interview with the creative director of Red Steel 2, Jason Vandenberg. We also ask him some very detailed questions about the game's controls, creative influence, use during its creation, and how to pronounce his name.
That is a really good interview. You should check it out.
Yeah, it is actually really good. We asked some great questions.
Yeah, in fact, the guy actually compliments us on how good of an interview it is inside the interview.
James has finally reviewed Glory of Heracles, which, if you hadn't heard it already, says it's a decent story. It's a very ordinary combat system.
Very boring.
It does everything you'd expect from a JRPG, but doesn't dare go beyond that. And, of course, be sure to check out our sibling podcast of unspecified gender, the NWR Newscast, where their game club feature will be Mega Man 10. Play through it and discuss it with them.
Well, you can read all of that and more at NintendoWorldReport.com. Okay, we're back with listener mail, and I'll be reading the first letter. It's from Adrian in Birmingham, UK. I recently got Guitar Hero 5 on the Wii, which I'll freely admit is the first music game I've ever spent more than 10 minutes with. It's a good game, and as music as a hobby of mine, it has sparked my interest. I think games of this ilk, including Rock Band and Guitar Hero games, while not overly faithful to actually playing an actual guitar, do a great job of replicating the fun challenge of sight reading when you attempt a song without memorizing anything first. The biggest issue with Guitar Hero, in my opinion, is its lack of flexibility when it comes to improvising and the like, something Wii Music attempted. Critically, Wii Music was poorly received, but it seems to me that there's a good deal of potential there. Another interesting music tool on a games console was, of course, the Korg DS10. Are there any areas of the music genre you feel are ripe to be explored by game/interactive software, one that perhaps deserves another music-based attempt from Nintendo? Finally, if you had free reign over a successor to Wii Music, what approach would you choose to take? What a minefield.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
Maybe we should have broken that question up a little bit.
Well, I mean, in terms of stuff that hasn't been done, I would like to actually see... I think there's still kind of room for a game that could actually train you how to really play an instrument, but in an interactive game type manner.
So,
you know?
So you mean like Tony Hawk Ride trains you to ride a skateboard?
No, that's not what I mean at all. No, but I mean like seriously teach you how to play an instrument, but not in a corny kind of way.
I agree. I think there's still kind of a space there that hasn't really been done. I think there have been some attempts from it, mainly with PC stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it ends up being kind of Rosetta Stone kind of educational software and not really a game.
Yeah, let's teach you typing sort of thing.
Right, Mario teaches typing, which is not really a game.
No.
Yeah, I think there's a kind of a crossover zone there in between gaming and learning that probably could still be mined. But that's not Wii Music for sure.
No. I suppose we should mention Nintendo's other musical venture, Band Brothers, in Japan.
Yeah.
Which, of course, never come out in the West. But I think that has some sort of song creation tool in it.
It does.
It's kind of a composition tool. It's a bit like Mario Paint's music editor, but a lot more sophisticated and flexible.
Yeah, I find it a little weird about why that hasn't come over. I mean, I guess, yeah, it's not an immediate transfer because, of course, you've got to put together a song list that's going to work for the territories you want to bring it to, which obviously the Japanese one wouldn't. And I think it's pretty long. I mean, there's a surprising amount of stuff packed in, especially to the DX version. But by now, I kind of would have thought they might have done, but they haven't. So I'm not sure what it is, because maybe it's something about the game they don't think would translate quite as well.
Yeah, I don't know. I've played Band Brothers briefly with TYP. He's a big fan of those games, and I played it with him at E3 several years ago, and I thought it was good, although, you know, it was hard for me to jump into. We were playing kind of cooperatively multiplayer or something like that, and right. He basically, you know, totally dominated the whole proceedings because he knew what he was doing, and I was just trying to learn. But it seemed fun. I mean, that was a neat game, and there was a little bit of improvisation. I think you could kind of add extra effects or something, or maybe there were some solo sections. He would really be the person to speak on that, because I'm just kind of vaguely remembering.
But I suppose the Wii music issue, I mean, wasn't universally panned. I mean, there's some people that saw kind of, that seemed to get the point of it to some extent, yeah, that liked it. But I mean, Chris Kohler didn't seem to think it was particularly bad, for instance, I remember. But, I mean, certainly, I think it would be more attractive, and two really simple things that don't even so much to do with the gameplay, it's just the instrument quality and the amount of the music in it. I mean, I just think, you know, the public domain stuff done with, you know, really quite subpar instrument quality. I don't know what constraints are involved with that, just with how much better they could make
mainly
it.
Mainly budgetary.
Perhaps so. To me, just gives, it does, you know, it just doesn't make it seem, even to whatever extent you can, you feel like you can express yourself within the constraints of that game. I don't know that it necessarily makes people feel like they're going to be able to fashion something that they're going to really, you know, get something out of, when that's the kind of palette that you're working with, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, I think Wii Music was geared towards school children. I mean, Miyamoto was pretty overt about that, and that's cool. I mean, you know, it's not the first time Nintendo's made stuff like that. They made the Pokemon Channel game for GameCube, and that was originally, I remember Max Late got a tip on this this has been like 2001, and he told me kind of off the record, he had some sources who said Nintendo was making a game for babies. And I was like, seriously? I mean, it actually doesn't sound that shocking now. But back in 2001, it was like, what are you talking about, man? And it turned out to be that Meowth's Party demo that they showed at Space World that year.
Oh, really?
It was right before that, which didn't really come out, but it sort of evolved into Pokemon Channel several years later. But yeah, I mean, the idea for that was to make a Pokemon game for children who were basically too young to play the real Pokemon.
Well, see, it makes sense, though, because basically it was the Pokemon TV show with, like,
right,
six different episodes on at one time.
Right.
And you just picked the episodes you wanted to watch. So I guess it makes sense that Pokemon for babies would be the way of describing that game.
Yeah. Anyway, Wii Music is kind of Guitar Hero for babies in a way, in that, you know, it is very freeform. And if you look at the music selection that was in that game, I mean, they had Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. Like, that really says it all. It is a child song. It's something that you would never, ever sing if you're older than 5 years old. And now you can play it. And I think the concept of Wii Music, I don't know if it can be executed in a way that I would want to play. I do appreciate the motivation behind it, which is to make something that's more freeform, that allows more creativity and more improvisation than you get in Rock Band or Guitar Hero. So I appreciate that. I just don't know that Nintendo really found a way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the execution was very lacking, partly for the things that Greg said, and then also the controls weren't good enough. In fact, I would not be that surprised to hear, because, you know, Nintendo's even said they're interested in keeping that game alive or trying to find a different way to sell it to people. And it wouldn't surprise me to see a Wii Music Plus that actually uses Motion Plus to interpret a broader and more intricate array of actual motions, so you can't just shake the controller to play violin. And, you know, that might be interesting if they did it really well. I think Nintendo, if they ever do any kind of sequel, or I guess in the spirit of the question, if I were making a sequel to Wii Music, I would probably limit the instruments down to 10 or 5 instead of 55.
Yeah.
Because I think especially if you're going to use more faithful controls and interpret data from something like Wii Motion Plus, I think you have to limit yourself a little more. But they don't necessarily have to be stuff like guitar. I mean, they can be things that are interesting for people to play that you don't get to do in other games. But I think if you throw in, it's like Chrono Cross, the RPG with 40, 50 different playable characters.
Yes.
You know, when you put that much shit in your game, each individual piece of it is not going to be that good. And that's kind of what I got out of Wii Music, is that there were so many instruments in there. They ended up just being special effects. It ended up just being a dial that you would turn on your Casio keyboard. It doesn't really mean anything, you know, and again, they don't actually sound good. So I think they would be better served by limiting the scope a little more, probably using some licensed music. I know that might be difficult to find people who are willing to let their songs be manipulated in this way. But there was that Battle of the Bands game on Wii where, you know, you were playing like Green Day songs with a marching band and shit like that. Mm-hmm. So it's not unprecedented.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I just wanted to bring up is what Rock Band is doing with their Rock Band network, where bands can actually create, I guess they can create actually the, what are they called, note lists?
Yeah, you do the tracking yourself.
Yep, so that's kind of cool. That's something that's...
Or you can pay someone to do it for you.
Yeah.
And they collect royalties. Yeah, that launched today, actually, and I... downloaded the update for Rock Band 2 and looked at the store for Rock Band Network and didn't really see anything I wanted to buy. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of songs you can get for $1, which is nice. Some of them are $2, which is the standard Rock Band price. But it's something I'll keep an eye on for sure. James, I want to know what you would do with Wii Music.
I would not make it. No, I'm serious. I think
take it out to the backyard and shoot it for letting us know.
I think
so
the Wii Music name is bad.
So you would start a new ad campaign with Beyonce to remarket the existing Wii Music?
No, I would start a new marketing campaign with Beyonce to market something that has nothing to do with Wii Music.
A new brand.
Yeah, that brand is toxic.
You think?
I think that's probably a bit much.
I think what they'd have to do is they'd have to create something that's more game and less music.
Maybe. I don't know. I think you could go either way with it in terms of making it better. I think you could make it better but still actually, you know, appeal to the same sort of audience, you know, skewing younger or skewing to the family. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, look, I mean, if he was going to go more in the gamer direction, yeah, you'd probably want to junk the brand and start again.
Yeah, just burn it. Just burn it all. It all needs to go. I mean, just disavow that game happened.
Oh man, that's rough. I think it was a failure for Nintendo in that it did not meet their expectations. Mm-hmm. But I don't necessarily think it was a bad idea. I don't think it should have been their premier holiday game of that holiday season. But
it just never made sense to me how they let it go. You know what I mean? Mm. Like how did somebody not go, whoa, guys, this is not up to our quality standards?
I do think it was kind of the moment when Nintendo's try anything philosophy of this generation did seem to backfire a little bit. And mm-hmm. that, yeah, I mean, I think you're right, James. I think at some point, Miyamoto or someone should have stepped in and said, well, this is a good idea at the core, but you guys really need to do something a little different with this or take it in a somewhat different angle before we can release this. And it does seem like eventually they just kind of gave up and just shat it out onto the
shelves.
Well,
we heard about it. How long were we hearing about it before it came out? A while.
Well, it was from the beginning.
Yeah.
From the very beginning.
Yeah, keep in mind, Wii Music was the first Wii game ever shown. Yeah. To the press.
Yeah, yep. Wii Music has existed forever, essentially.
Yep.
No, I mean, it went on far long. I mean, it seemed like it was troubled.
Yeah, so I think it had a stay in development hell, and I feel like maybe that should have been their sign that...
Yeah, I think eventually they just kind of gave up and said, well, it would cost too much to make this good, so...
Mm-hmm. Or at the very least, if you're going to put out something that you've had struggling in development hell for years, let it be disaster.
Mm-hmm. Seriously, I mean, Nintendo is not the kind of company to just put development hell out there, with the exception of, say, Odama, which was extreme development hell.
We need to do Odama on Retroactive sometime.
We do.
We really should do that. It's the Japanese military history pinball game, RTS.
Seriously, yeah, who thought that was a great idea?
With voice controls, let's not forget that.
So, moral of the story, merge Wii Music with Odama.
Yes, I think Wii Music needs a pinball and Japanese RTS element to it. I think you create music to boost their morale.
Yeah,
I guess exactly. That's
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. That's what they should merge it with.
Put on the cat suit.
Yep. Children's Television Workshop should get a part of that.
All right. John has the next question.
Oh, my God.
All right. Ryan from Anaheim, California writes, how, if at all, do you think Nintendo will respond to the Xbox 360, Xbox Live game room? Thus far, Virtual Console Arcade has been anything but amazing. With lower prices, a larger selection, and a flashier presentation, Microsoft is poised to make Nintendo look even more foolish. Can Virtual Console Arcade even compete? Do you think Nintendo cares? They announced the service a year ago and have completely pissed away their head start on game room.
Yeah, I don't think Nintendo ever did care about Virtual Console Arcade.
Have any been released? I can't even remember any being released.
Well, I mean,
since for a while. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in Japan, they put out, I think, more than 60 games or something at this point. They're almost all Namco games.
Mm-hmm. Go figure.
Mappy 2, Mappy 3, Mappy 4.
There's some stuff that kind of looks interesting, but I haven't really been, apart from Starblade, I haven't bought any of them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's stuff you can get on other collections and things like this. And then maybe you've got a few other little oddities here and there from Sega. I think Sega just released Zaxxon.
In
Japan and Europe, so maybe that's going to come to America at some point.
John, you downloaded Space Harrier, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
So you actually own one. The only arcade game I have on Virtual Console is Gaplus, which is that sequel to Galaga, and it's neat, but it's so hard I can't really play it. So I haven't touched it in a long time.
The thing is that in terms of Nintendo's indifference to it, I mean, I think, you know, the fact that you just wouldn't have, like, the proper Donkey Kong on there, I think it's pretty mind-blowing, because that's money. I mean, that has got to be money.
Yeah.
Right there. You are going to make very significant revenue on that. Now, this is not the compromised NES version. You know, this is the version that, you know, was in everyone's arcades. It just seems like that is waiting to be tapped, and yet they can't be bothered. So
remember, the arcade service was announced at GDC last year, and GDC is coming up very soon.
It's
now.
It's been a year.
They're going to announce they're getting rid of it.
So maybe they'll have some kind of update. Maybe they'll say, "Oh yeah, and we remembered that we have Virtual Console Arcade, so we're going to put some new
games
out."
Put out Mappy 4, as John has alluded to.
Yep.
But they haven't really seemed to secure the, you know, arcade support from people like, you know, Konami, Capcom, who would have a pretty big sort of suite of classics that they could bring to it. Where are they? You know, I mean, it's just pretty much just been Namco all the way in Japan. A few of the older games from Sega, rather than anything of their, you know, the latter day stuff. Very much mid-80s kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, and I think the Wii's ability to emulate, you know, some like late 90s arcade units is probably difficult. I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not making a crack on the Wii's power, but emulating some of those arcade boards is tricky business. And emulation in general is very, very processor and RAM intensive. And a lot of times, you know, there might be, I mean, like, you know, some of those Sega arcade games from the 90s before Dreamcast and the Naomi board kind of standardized stuff, some of those arcade boards, you know, are so idiosyncratic that
it's probably
very difficult to emulate that board, and you might only be doing it for one game. So it's just not worth the effort. And that's one reason that, you know, it's emulating arcade games is tough, especially as they get more complex.
Yeah. Well, and let's be honest, and I know this is going to upset some people, but arcade games before 1984 sucked.
Yeah, they were awful.
The vast majority of them are awful.
I think what they do with Game Room, though, because there's going to be a lot of really old games at Game Room, obviously.
And those are awful.
Atari games, you know, early arcade games. You know, that's,
I think there's a lot of Atari 2600 games, actually.
Yeah, exactly. So you're really old stuff. But I guess what they're going to kind of do to some extent that's going to make it more valuable as an experience, first of all, it's going to be a lot cheaper, as Ryan mentioned. But the other thing is you've got this whole online leaderboards, and like you can sort of almost like make people like take up a challenge, which is sort of like getting an achievement. So like, I don't know, or like maybe a little bit like retro game challenge, like, okay, do this,
and you can rewind the games too.
So all this kind of stuff, just, you know, making it more integrated and making, you know, because so many of these old games were score leveraged, and it was a case of, you know, putting your best score onto this machine where you were, wherever you would play it, you know, kind of recreating that somewhat of a, you know, even better really, because it's going to be with your friends and maybe you could get a bit of rivalry going and stuff, which, you know, with Virtual Console Arcade, it's just never going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although having said that, they have done, is actually the only kind of Virtual Console releases that have been somewhat enhanced, like for instance, you know, Pointer Control in Starblade. So, I mean, to be fair, at least the Virtual Console Arcade release have been somewhat progressive in that way, but in terms of like online leaderboards, like, apparently that's not something they're ever going to do.
And to make a commentary on the arcade appeal here, now I know I made the comment somewhat tongue-in-cheek that everything made before 1984 sucked, but a lot of the games that came out on arcade games back then were basically the same game with a different skin on it.
Yeah, and even Nintendo was guilty of doing that with, you know, Radar Command and
there are seven or eight games that are essentially Pac-Man that Namco released on the Pac-Man hardware.
Sure.
Well, Tower of Druaga is a great example. It's essentially a Pac-Man maze, only there's no dots. And you run around and try to get to a key. That's it. Congratulations, you've played the game.
And then Miyamoto made Devil World, which is a Pac-Man clone.
Yes.
For any, it was, that's for Famicom, not arcade. But
So the question is, I'm not sure how big the appeal is, so Nintendo probably just neglects it.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I think, you know, if they had Strider for Virtual Console Arcade, I'd get it.
Yeah,
but we haven't got that. You know, there's a whole bunch of stuff that you could pick out.
There is, but
like that. But they're just not doing it, apart from Namco, really. I mean, Namco were quite unafraid to put out a bunch of arcade versions of stuff that had console versions on the Virtual Console already, like Splatterhouse and bunch of shooters and all this stuff. They didn't mind that.
Yeah.
Everyone else, like Capcom and Konami, they're not interested in getting into that. Or like, I mean, there's some really, I mean, I'd love to see, Konami have got a number of shooters in the arcade that were way ahead of anything you could put on the consoles at the time.
Yeah.
And which I would love to see. I mean, I think, was it, I'm not sure how you pronounce this, but it's something like ZXX or XX or something that looks amazing.
You don't mean Zexus, do you? Because that was on NES.
Yeah,
No, it's from 99. This is from 91. This is a Konami shooter from 91. It's way more advanced than even the Super NES could handle. So it looks amazing. I mean, you could have that on Wii, you know, sort of 90s sensibility design of a shooter, but it looks way better than anything you actually played back then. Mm-hmm. I guess unless you're an avid arcade gamer in Japan, maybe, then I would love to play that kind of stuff. You know, kind of lost classics and stuff that isn't just better versions of things that are on consoles, but no one's biting.
No.
Yeah. What can I say?
A lot of that, in the end, will come down to whether or not the people who own the licenses care.
Yeah.
Does Nintendo care?
See, no.
That, just to go back to the question, I mean, it, you know, does Nintendo, are they going to respond to Xbox Game Room?
No.
No, I don't think they give a shit.
No,
do they respond to anything ever?
Not really, but like, no. I think Microsoft is very smart to do it. I think it'll probably work out for them, especially if they actually get good games. I mean, there's rumors that they're going after, like, Dreamcast games. And the 360 can probably handle that. You know, the Wii probably could not.
There was a rumor about Dreamcast games on PSN as well, wasn't there, a bit ago? I mean,
Yeah.
Yep.
That would be cool. You know, I never owned a Dreamcast, so I mean, I'm very interested in Game Room. I don't know how much money I'll really spend on it, because I'm not interested in arcade games from 1979. You know, I'm not going to spend $3 on them.
No way.
But I think it's a cool idea. I'm, you know, interested to see if they bring up anything from my childhood, you know, maybe from the late 80s, early to mid 90s, that kind of stuff. But yeah, Virtual Console Arcade is one of those things that when Nintendo first announced it, did any of us really think they were going to support it all that well?
No.
I mean, by that time, even Virtual Console was kind of petering out a lot.
Exactly. I mean, Virtual Console has slowed down. I mean, even in Japan now, especially since Namco seems to have backed off or, you know, dumped all the stuff they had ready for the Virtual Console Arcade, you're down to one game a week in Japan, and less than that in the Western territories. So you'd be very much against the direction of travel at this point.
Well, I mean, even in that report that was posted on the site recently, they said that they expected basically the money that they're making off of VC to keep going down and WiiWare to keep going up.
Well, the reason for that is because of the top grossing VC game for that year, 2009, was Super Mario Bros. 3.
Yep.
And actually World of Goo, which is a much more expensive game, three times expensive, was not far behind.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the thing about Super Mario Bros. 3 is that that's going to make, especially 2009, a lot of that must still be new adopters. But of course, as we expect the Wii sales to tail off because you know they've already sold so many and they've just had a price cut, so you know they're going to sort of tail off from that price cut bump. Then that percentage of VC sales that's associated with new adopters is going to drop off, whereas the new content of WiiWare, which is more for people who have owned the system for a while, is going to increase and take over. So yeah, I mean that is the direction we're going in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know. But when something really cool gets released on Virtual Console, I think people buy it. I think a lot of people probably picked up Blaster Master and Majora's Mask. And
the Majora's Mask is high on that list.
Yeah, and that came out last summer. And I think there are still plenty of good games, even first-party games, that Nintendo hasn't released. And yeah, I just don't understand. We talk about it all the time, but I really don't understand what they're doing with Virtual Console, because they talk about their revenues from VC are going down this year, but it doesn't have to be that way. You know, at the very least, they could remarket some of the stuff that's already on there. And they occasionally talk about stuff on Nintendo Week, but that's reaching a small percentage of Wii owners.
Yes.
You know, I think probably a lot of Wii owners don't even know that Virtual Console exists.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Nintendo would be very wise to produce a commercial and show people all the cool games that they can download. Even, you know, some of these have been out since 2006, 2007 on the service.
Well, it says Super Mario 3. I mean, like, it seems to me like a lot of the people who are buying that in 2009 are people that just got a Wii and by whatever, you know, serendipity, they became aware of the Virtual Console service. And it's like, oh, there it is. You know, my favorite game ever, or, you know, this cherished game from my childhood. Let's get it. So and perhaps the point being, you could get a lot more of those people if you did have a sort of a broad awareness raising campaign.
And the shop needs to be redesigned. It's really poorly
laid
out.
Yeah, it's goofy to navigate.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the interface
it's goofy
and all that.
Everything.
Especially now that you have Swell to a point where you have, you're getting on for 400 games in America and over 550 in Japan. It is
not to mention WiiWare.
Yeah, of course. But the funny thing is, I mentioned it a bit ago, is you had in Europe a commercial dedicated strictly to online, you know, what the Wii can do online.
Mm-hmm.
And so it talks about Guitar Hero online, I think it was Band Hero to be specific, or Mario Kart Wii. And WiiWare didn't mention Virtual Console. So.
Yeah, that's sad because as much as it seems like, you know, a lot of stuff on Virtual Console is probably pretty niche. There probably aren't that many people who are interested in it. But there are, you know, especially with the lapsed gamers and all these other people that the Wii audience includes, I think there are a lot of people who are interested in that. You know, like my sister and brother-in-law, they have several games on Virtual Console. And, you know, they're not hardcore gamers at all. But I told them that, hey, you can go download. Actually, they came and played it at my place when the Wii was relatively new. They came and played Bomberman and Punch-Out and all this various stuff, Donkey Kong Country, which my sister loves. And they went home and, you know, when they, a couple months later, they bought their own Wii, that was one of the first things they did was jump on there and buy $50 worth of Wii points and start downloading Virtual Console games. All they needed to know was that you could.
Yes, well, certainly. That's the other part. Like, you could talk about a mainstream thing like a commercial or whatever, which certainly could raise awareness and maybe, you know, like you said, just prod in the little, you know, prod in the direction. And then the rest will take care of itself. The other way of doing that is more what you've got with Game Room, where you kind of build it into this kind of community kind of interface and that, you know, kind of, you know, so it shows up on your achievements or it does all this kind of stuff. And of course, Nintendo's infrastructure doesn't really allow for that. I mean, I guess
for Wii HD.
Yeah, I guess you could like have spit out things to the Wii message board and stuff, but that is pretty limited.
Okay, James has the next letter.
Okay, so Matt from Mississauga, Ontario writes, "Hello, it's Gearbox Clock from the forums. I'm writing this to talk about two mostly unrelated topics. First, I want to give a shout-out to Perfect Dark Game Boy Game, to the Perfect Dark Game Boy Game. I found a copy at the local flea market, and I love it. As far as I know, it's one of the few Game Boy games to have an inbuilt rumble pack. The only real problem is that it's incredibly difficult. The tutorial is harder than a lot of other games. And now the second topic, emotion in video games. Now that there are obvious emotional responses, laughter or anger/frustration, what are some games that you have played that have brought out an emotional response? Having recently played through Elite Beat Agents, I'd include that the "you're the inspiration" scene of the game.
That, I mean, that's a great example. I remember playing that and being very surprised by, I mean, it didn't affect me that emotionally, but I was surprised that the game's tone took such a sharp turn at that point.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
so
but it's also funny that it still incorporates the humor, like, because if you start failing at that game, the poor dad that passed away, you kind of find embarrassing pictures of him.
It's
stuff,
a little bit
so.
Dark, too. I mean, what happens if
it's kind of it doesn't feel like it's outside of the, you know, world of that game in terms of it's still silly, right. But I guess it still manages to be touching a little. I mean, I might even say the same as some parts of Chrono Trigger, because that's a whimsical game, really.
Yeah.
But some parts of it can then kind of be surprisingly touching, like when Luca has to see herself watch her mother get paralyzed in that accident.
Yeah. You can save the mother.
Yeah, you can do it, but it's...
You're not going to do it the first time, probably, but it's
no,
possible.
Because you won't know to.
L-A-R-A.
It's quite sad because it's like she had to watch it happen helplessly once, and then you're kind of watching yourself helpless watch it again. It's just little bits like that were quite well done, but without, you know, breaking the kind of whimsical paradigm of the game storytelling.
Right. Well, I think it's interesting, we were talking about this a bit during the break, but I think it's kind of interesting maybe to talk about the spectrum of emotion that you can get out of games. I mean, have you guys ever been scared by a game or felt...
Well, you certainly can feel a lot more, like, I don't know if it's scared, but definitely like really tense and kind of uptight about, because if something's really atmospheric, but there's also that fear of failure, you don't want to lose progress or whatever it would be.
The two
kind of intersect in a way, for a unique kind of tension that you wouldn't get just out of a sort of cinematic experience.
Well, I actually was, the first time I played Eternal Darkness, I got pretty creeped out by it all, but I was also playing it like at night in a house by myself for like a week.
Nice.
which is literally the absolute worst conditions you can play that game in.
Or best. Depending on your point of view.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
Because it got to the point where I was like, all right, game needs to turn off because no more of this.
Yeah. What about games that made you really happy?
Well, I mean, I guess the most fun games, things that, like, Galaxy for me is just so much, the sort of freedom of it in some ways, like doing the huge long jump and sort of going into semi-orbit around the planets, and you're just kind of messing with the rules of that game, for instance, is a very kind of joyful kind of experience rather than just like strictly fun in the gameplay sense, I guess.
I thought it was a little too automatic for me to get real happy from that, but the music in Galaxy definitely hit me in the happy zone.
Everything is embellished by the music in that game.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, it's like the old school Mario games. Every time I would play a new one, it would just feel like I was just, I'm back home again kind of thing.
See, I struggle with just that feeling of just bliss playing a game because
James is never happy.
Well, no, that's not the kind of games that would inspire that aren't the kind of games that I go for either. I mean, I have fun playing games. I never go like, I'm going to get Nobi Nobi Boy and get inspired to be experience joy from it.
I don't see that. That's not what I got from Johnny.
mostly confusion from Nobi Nobi.
Yeah.
But I can't think of one that's just made me blissfully happy or something playing it.
No, it's a weird one. I mean, obviously, the game's narratives have the potential to deliver pretty much the range of emotions that would happen in other storytelling media, perhaps embellished by the fact that you're more involved in it because it's interactive. But for the most part, they haven't really been up to par, so they haven't necessarily been all that effective in that many cases.
I don't really think story in games usually does a whole lot for me. It's usually the other parts of it, the music or the graphics or the control or some kind of exploration design.
Atmospheres, sense of place.
Yeah, I mean, it's a game that we've maybe talked about too much, but I think actually the last level in Flower is probably the most blissful I've ever felt playing a video game. And that's what it's going for. I mean, it's designed to get that out of you, but I think it's very good at it.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, the thing about Flower, obviously, the imagery is just in itself arresting. Mm-hmm. But there is something about the extent to which you interact with it, which somehow just makes it more powerful than it otherwise would be. If I was just watching a video of it, in the same perfect clarity and the surround sound and all that. You know, it wouldn't have the same effect. And even though your interaction isn't that huge, I mean, it's just, you know, hold the button and tilt the controller, it definitely does have a more powerful effect. And certainly when you get to the end, you've got the whole thing of, you have that level where you have to very carefully avoid touching the towers because they kind of repel you. And then you get to the end, and it's like now you could just obliterate those towers just by touching them. And that is something that I like in games, which is that feeling of empowerment where they put restrictions on you, and then they take them off and they let you kind of go on this sort of orgy. And I think the Metroid series has got great
examples of that. I was about to say, Screw Attack. When you get the Screw Attack in Super Metroid, and you basically just start tearing shit up, that's a really
cool Screw Attack
feeling.
Works on multiple levels because it's not only that you could destroy what were really tough, you know, enemies that you had to kind of methodically kill before, but also you just the fact that, boy, whereas before you would have had to, like, maybe carefully jump over lava pits or grapple this or do they, it's completely liberating on pretty much every level. But then also kind of slightly more narrative driven stuff, like we talked last week about the End of Zero mission where you're re-empowered, or for instance the final battle of Super Metroid where you are helpless and then are given the wind beam, which you need to absolutely destroy. you destroy Mother Brain, just, you know, that it has no chance, but it's fun. It just feels great to watch its head just go,
you know, actually, I have another good emotion example. Final Fantasy VI, it was Final Fantasy III when I played it, but when you get to the World of Ruin, there is a really pervasive sadness about that game for a while. And it's weird because it goes away a little bit as you go, as you kind of round up all of your old friends. Although it is possible for a couple of them to actually die. Like Shadow. Yeah, Shadow. I usually rename him Edge because I'm a big FF4 fan. But yeah, Shadow the ninja guy, he can actually die. And you go and, you know, eventually you find out that one of your other characters, Realm, is probably his daughter. It's a little hard to dig up that information. It's through some dream sequences in a certain town, I think. But there's some pretty melancholy stuff in that, and mainly just the feeling of walking around the overworld with the new music. Everything's kind of brown. It's almost like a nuclear wasteland. And you realize, I mean, when I first played that, I kept thinking, well, you know, where's the quest that I have to do to turn it back the way it was? Eventually, over the course of several hours and it really going around the world and talking to people, you kind of realize there's no going back. This is the new reality within that game. And the characters in the game are just going to have to figure out a way to make a new life for themselves that is the best they can do. You know?
Yeah.
There's a bit of that in Chrono Trigger as well after the Kingdom of Zeal falls and, you know, you have the mixture of the people from the lower earth and the people from the upper world, and they're now having to kind of create a new civilization.
Yeah, for me in that game, it was the part where you have the opera. That's just
an amazing scene.
Yeah, it's an amazing sequence. It's really, really striking to me.
It's almost romantic in a way.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not that I had that much invested in the characters involved, but it evokes an authentic feeling of romance, I think.
Yeah.
And I can't think of really very, very, very few video games that can actually pull that off.
Well, that's why I never forgot it, because it just seemed so, it was just put in there for no purpose other than to evoke that feeling in the player.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, they easily could have just had you talk to an NPC and just have some, you know, silly little song play and there you go. But instead it was this grand sequence that you have to sit there and watch, and it's actually really, really good operatic music.
And you do get involved with it at different points, and you kind of interact with it. That's a very interesting thing. I don't think we've ever talked about it on the podcast before, but the whole opera scene is a landmark in game storytelling and, you know, what games can do emotionally and, you know, for Final Fantasy. I think it's one of the great moments of any Final Fantasy game.
I would agree.
I mean, one thing I think that's more effective about games, sort of talked about, you know, fear and tension and all that, but also, you know, the thing about games typically is as you mentioned with the FF6 situation, is that when there are problems, you assume you are meant to fix them. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of probably video game players will be inspired to have Messiah complexes for the rest of their lives, I think, because it's like, you know, you think of Majora's Mask and it's like, if someone mentions that their coffee wasn't particularly good that day, you probably think you can travel back in time and fix it. You know, the thing is that what happens is when you can't fix something, when something bad happens and you can't change it, that has more of an effect on you, because it's like your expectations were that, you know, you could make it better, which of course is not something you can't really ever engage like that with something in non-interactive entertainment, and your expectations are probably more that, you know, bad stuff happens and that's just the way it is.
There's a bit of that in Braid at the very end, but I don't want to spoil it.
Also, Wind Waker, because, I mean, I felt like, yeah, you're going to bring Hyrule back, aren't you, at some point? And then, you know, when it comes to the end, it's like, no, it's not coming back. But, you know, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah.
So I think that kind of, again, just that's the kind of different kind of investment that you can get in a game. And that's why it probably is more effective at evoking certain kinds of emotions, but then, you know, we're probably still farther away from it being as effective as with others.
Okay, do we want to move on?
Well, we've talked about, what, two emotions really, sadness and happiness in specific, but this doesn't really cover the whole range, I suppose. Is there, like, excitement or just this, holy shit, what am I experiencing right now? Kind of, like, how would you describe that emotion?
Well, you know, that happens a lot. Especially, I think the feeling of excitement or astonishment is more tied to, a lot of times, technology or, you know, kind of the latest in cinematic stuff. I mean, I think of stuff like Uncharted 2. Mm-hmm. It's not something that I can really get from... If I go back and play a lot of games that I'm nostalgic about from my childhood, I'm not going to get those emotions. So I guess they feel more fleeting, but it's definitely possible to get that out of a game.
See, well, where I do it is usually where maybe not the game design is intentionally geared to cause this particular instant to be amazing, but elements of the game design came together to cause something that is slowly pulling me into it. So a good example would be when I went through that long kick playing Ace Combat, where it was something would happen and then, like, the dynamic music would kick in and would start gearing up, and as you realized you were slowly being pulled into it until you were just like, oh my god, everything needs to die, and you realized I didn't need to do that and I just got way too psyched up to do that and I also ran out of time. Nice job, me.
So the game pulls you into, like, a murderous rampage.
Well, not that. It pulls me into being so supremely focused
absorbed
and excited on what is going on right now. Like,
I feel like most games do that. Or they try to.
The really good ones. Yeah.
I mean, most RPGs try to make you love the characters. That doesn't mean they're successful.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, that's a good segue, because I wanted to ask, maybe one emotion that we've only barely touched on is love. Is there a game that can actually make you love? I mean, that seems so interpersonal.
Well,
or at least, is there a game that can make you feel like, that can maybe just expose you to a sense of love? Maybe it's between two characters in the game and you're just kind of on the outside watching it, but it's truly touching or something. That's kind of going back to the example of You're the Inspiration in Elite Beat Agents. That's kind of what you're getting out of that, right?
Yeah, I mean, maybe a little bit. I mean, Dawn of the New World is silly and the dialogue is bad, but the game really only has two characters, and the entire basically plot of the game is those two characters are slowly bonding into each other, and to the point where they don't exist if the other one's not there. Whenever one's separated from the other, and it happens intermittently, the only thing that the other one can think about is going to find the one that's just disappeared.
There's some kind of nice moments of like that in Resident Evil 4 with Leon and Ashley, where she feels so vulnerable that when she does get taken away, you actually feel bad about it, mm-hmm. you know, and you actually feel worried and you want to get her back.
Well,
I felt that way, at least. I was surprised at how effective it was in that. It's not totally cheesy. Like, it actually works for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think stuff like that, the better the characterization gets, the more that's going to be effective, you know, in terms of feeling some sort of affection for the characters in general, and therefore becoming invested in what happens. That they have to be more human, and we're getting there, but it's still, you know, quite a long road to hoe, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, what is it? What's the game escaping me now? Maybe people who made Shadow of the Colossus. Eco.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that the whole game is basically sold on the premise of yeah. understanding the interpersonal relationships of these characters.
Right. There's a bond there, and you're trying to preserve that bond. That's the game.
Yeah, yeah. And apparently that's kind of the game in Fragile, which is coming out in a couple weeks. It's kind of the same premise. I see a few games that try to do that well. I think part of what has to happen is if that other character is, you know, in the world, they have to actually play a meaningful role in it. They just can't be someone you interact with in cutscenes and things. That's kind of why the Pharah example doesn't quite work here from Prince of Persia. Because while Pharah is an interesting character, and while she and the prince have really good dialogue, she's never really there, unless she's shooting like arrows from a balcony.
She's always kind of on a parallel path to you, right? Like, you hardly ever actually directly interact with her. You're hardly ever standing next to her or doing anything back-to-back.
She might
back
flip a switch somewhere or something for you.
Yeah, it seems like she's always kind of off to the side. Yeah, it's an interesting point, and I think it's something that, if you look at the 2008 Prince of Persia, you know, the cel-shaded one,
right.
It's something that they tried to address with that, because they wanted Elika to be like Pharah, in that it would be a female character that you grow fond to and, you know, you care about, and she helps you, but they obviously worked in ways for her to interact much more directly with you. So she's holding your hand, and, you know, she's helping you in combat. But, you know, I'm not sure that they quite got there, but you can kind of tell that they looked at that as a chance to kind of evolve what they had tried to innovate with in Sands of Time.
Well, and part of the problem with her character is that Elika just wasn't as good a character as Pharah either.
Yeah, she's a little too goody-two-shoes. She's too magical, you know? Yeah. I mean, she is literally magical in the game.
She can freaking fly.
Right. But yeah, she doesn't really feel human like Pharah did, and therefore her interaction with the prince it's not as endearing.
I do think, though, to get the feeling of emotion between the two characters, it's necessary to explore the whole range of emotion that you normally have if you're trying to get sort of a feeling of affection between them. And that includes, at least at some point, touching on the bad parts that come out of that.
Yeah.
The negative emotion that comes with having an affection for somebody, which there is. I mean, it happens.
That's pretty ambitious for most games, you know, compared to what they do now.
But I think to really sell that point, to really sell the image of there being an affectionate bond between two non-existent characters in a virtual world, you really do have to kind of probe that emotional depths that exist there.
Well, and that's part of why Sands of Time works so well, is because the prince and Pharah, they kind of despise each other in the beginning.
Yeah.
And that really does add a layer to the affection that eventually comes out at the end. We should probably move on. I'm afraid some of our listeners might have tuned out over that discussion.
Yeah.
All right, so Greg actually has the last email.
This is from Sergeant Foster in Okinawa, and he writes, "In the last newscast, and more generally in the gaming community, the DSi XL is being referred to as something for old people only. As many of us that use the DS on the go, there's just as many that use it right at the crib and in the crib only. Greg said he likes to play RPGs on handhelds. Doesn't 93% bigger screen sound better for that? The DS/DSi can arguably hold its own against any console on the market with the amount of quality games it houses. An easier to see screen can also appeal to women, especially with the book reading stuff that's coming to the system. Yes, it's for a different market, but it's not necessarily for an elderly market."
I agree.
The only problem, and we've kind of probed in this a little bit, is that making the screen that much bigger is going to make things look that much blockier.
I don't think it's a huge issue. And actually, Chris Kohler, I watched his video review. Someone referred to it in our forums, and I went and watched it. And he did kind of the official Wired review of the DSi XL back when it was in Japan. And he said, you know, it can, in some games, make things look more pixelated, but usually it doesn't. Makes them look better.
Yeah, it seems to be that it just does look really, really nice, but from what a lot of people who've played on them say. I mean, I think that at the end of the day, I remember I had a Game Boy Player. I like playing Game Boy Advance games on the big screen. I mean, how much are you blowing that out of proportion?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I mean, I can handle it. And I guess this is like the closest thing you'll ever have to a Game Boy Player for the DS, because of the dual screen touchscreen. You can't play it on the TV, but this is pretty much as good as it's gonna get.
I would just be concerned with blowing up things like book reading.
The 100 classic books to me is kind of idea.
It's more than silly. They're in the public domain, so
I know they're free books. I mean, you can already get them for free if you have any. They're probably I'd probably rather read a book on my phone than on the DS. But that aside, I think the bigger screens actually probably do help with that reader. You know, I mean, well, they're still going to be very tiring on your eyes.
As long as the font is designed for that bigger screen.
And I'm sure you can change the font size.
Yeah,
I'm sure
pixelated fonts are the worst. Yeah. They will burn your eyes.
I mean, yeah. I'd say one of the weirdest things about the DSi XL for me is the fact that, you know, one of the advantages of the DSi that I see, especially, you know, as the software lineup that's for DSiWare kind of grows, is that, you know, you can have games loaded on there, and so you could have a choice of games without having to worry about taking a carry case with you and what you're going to put in that carry case and all that sort of stuff. But of course, that's very much for gaming on the go.
Yeah.
You know, which then you've got this pretty massive version of it.
It's huge.
Kind of goes against it. So it's kind of, I mean, in some ways, I almost feel like you might have been better off. I mean, they never would have done this, but if it's the home handheld, is putting the GBA functionality back, or like,
in the 2DS slots that they said they wanted to do at some point, that they wanted to have 2 game card slots in the system.
Well, that would have been useful. Honestly.
Vaguely.
I mean, the other thing is maybe making the D-pad buttons bigger, which they didn't.
Yeah, no, see, I think
that's
really weird.
Inexcusable. Yeah, that is inexcusable.
The fact that they literally just blew up a DSi is a little bit lazy for me in terms of like this whole thing of you're providing like a dedicated home handheld experience.
It's just so damn big, though. I mean, just looking at it, it's huge. It's got to weigh a ton.
Yeah, it's not that big. It's not like a freaking netbook or anything. It's not really pocket size anymore.
No. You know?
And the DS was always borderline pocket size to begin with. Even the DS Lite is not something that feels that great in my back jeans pocket, usually.
Well, how does it compare size-wise to, like, the massive gray DS that I have?
I think it's maybe slightly larger than the original DS Fat.
That thing is too busy to really be pocket size, so...
Yeah, the screens are just a way bigger percentage of it, way nicer looking.
Screens on mine
actually looks a little comical how much of that thing is taken up by LCDs.
Oh, no, but... it's not a little comical. It is pure comedy, honestly.
Well, so, here's the thing about the DSi XL. I mean, you guys are saying that maybe it's meant to be more of a home system, but I say not necessarily. I mean, you know, you can still put it in a backpack, you can still put it in a purse, you can still put it in a, you know, like if you're wearing cargo pants, you could put it in the leg pocket. I mean, these are not uncommon ways to carry things around. And again, I mean, I'm actually recording on my netbook right now, which I took to school today in my backpack.
Yeah, I mean, it's still not as big as a Kindle, so.
Yeah, just because it doesn't fit in your pants pocket doesn't mean it's not portable anymore.
It's still portable, but it's just not as convenient.
I understand, but how convenient really was the Game Boy Micro? That's the smallest handheld Nintendo's ever made, and did it change anyone's life that now you can
slip it
behind your ear?
Well, the problem with that, again, is like you would only ever have to have one game, wouldn't it? Because, you know, like the game cartridges were nearly as big as the damn system.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, if you were going to have multiple games, then all of a sudden you're pretty much doubling up on the size of the thing that you're taking with you anyway. Whereas that's the great thing about digital distribution. I mean, if you had something as small as a micro, but you had all these games that bought on it, then you might really be in business.
Sure. I was just going to say, I mean, as far as the XL goes, I'm actually a little bit tempted by it because I didn't buy a DSi. So this is kind of now a next step up, and the larger screens sound really nice to me. It also has longer battery life because there's a physically larger battery in it, just because there's more space for it. That sounds nice to me. I mean, and you know, I'm not playing DS as much anymore these days, and when I do, it's usually at home. And so that would work out pretty well, and it would be a chance to finally catch up on some DSiWare, like the art style games that actually sound great. The problem is the price. It's nearly $200. It costs almost as much as a Wii.
That's an excuse.
Yeah, $10 shy of
a Wii.
It's not quite. The disparity seems to be a bit less if you go for good online deals here, but yeah, it's still pretty similar. I mean, the bottom line is it's coming out today as we record this, as the day dawns, so does the DSi XL in Europe. And it's £10 more, I think, is pretty much what you look for. It's not too bad as a premium, I guess.
Well, that's the thing. In America, it's only $20 more than the regular DSi, and I think that's a very reasonable difference between those two. The problem is the DSi is already so
overpriced.
Yeah, that's the problem. That if the DSi costs $130 like the DS Lite does, and the DS Lite, I don't even know if they're still making. If they are, it should be $100, frankly.
It's still definitely still making.
But yeah, I mean, the DSi is way overpriced, okay? It's like $170. It's freaking ridiculous. If the XL costs around $150, I would be down for that. And the same, you know, like the PSP Go, like I was talking to a friend the other day, I would love to own a PSP. There's a lot of PSP games I've never played that I really want to, but even the PSP 3000 is still like $200. It's still too much for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the Go, which should actually be cheaper than the one with the drive, is instead $250. If the Go dropped down to $150, which is really what it should have been from the get-go,
yep,
then I would go out today and buy one.
$150,
I would go buy a PSP Go right now. But these handhelds are they're just pricing themselves out. And how many people are going to spend $200 for a DS?
Especially because we just had the all the consoles just took price cuts.
Yeah. And instead, Nintendo's just and Sony too are raising prices on handhelds.
It was after a recession where, you know, 6% of the size of the economy got wiped off. You know, most of the world's developed economies. You know,
it was gone.
Not only that, but the pace of price decreases was actually quite a lot slower than it was in the previous generation. As it was, so definitely now that they have come down, the handhelds don't look all that competitively priced, but I mean, I'm kind of tempted by it as well, actually.
I think it's a cool system. I can't justify spending that much money on it.
I guess the main thing is the fact that you have got more interesting DSiWare games now. You know, obviously we've talked about some of the like Dark Void Zero and the Heartstar stuff, but also Xscape. Yeah, that looks really cool. I'm very interested in that. And you know, stuff like we're using the stylus to control things like that, the extra screen real estate could probably help you a little bit, and other things like with precision stylus stuff, you know, could be a little bit easier. I'm not exactly sure how that works with blowing
going back to Elite Beat Agents. I wonder if that game might actually be more difficult to play on the XL.
Oh, it would be.
Your hand would have to travel farther.
Yeah, it absolutely
would. Oh, yeah, that's true, because it's based around the grouping. Yeah, that's an interesting point.
But it'd be more difficult to play on the DSi than the original DS2, probably, because the DSi has a bigger screen.
It said that, though, if you put it on the hardest mode, the dots got really small, so it would make that easier.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. On the hardest mode, the game is impossible anyway. I mean,
I'm sure Windy would disagree with you.
Yeah, I think I could play it on the second hardest mode, but not the hardest.
It's very difficult on the world.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting question, and you know, this would be a good chance to hear from our listeners. I mean, if you're planning to get an XL, or you know, if you hear this later, or you end up getting one and you play it, let us know what you think. I mean, let us know how you're using it. How does it compare for you in terms of your, you know, how does it fit into your lifestyle? Or what kind of games look really good on it? What kind of games look really bad on it? What games like Elite Beat Agents are actually more difficult to play because of the larger screen? That's pretty interesting stuff to me. So I'd like to hear about that. So if you have a report on it, send us an email. In fact, anyone can send us an email about anything. We've had so many good ones, and we're still catching up, but we're getting there. We're trying to go through the backlog here. So you can send your listener mail to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And as we wrap up the show, I'll just remind you, as you've already heard, we do have two other wonderful podcasts, Radio Trivia Podcast Edition and the NWR Newscast. And you can find links to all the episodes of both of those at nintendoworldreport.com. Okay, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Later.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
Anything else you guys want to mention? Any exciting things coming up? Or
I'm probably going to get us a Teleview game from the Virtual Console.
Oh, yes!
Bastard. It's not BS Zelda, is it?
It did come out as a cartridge much later, that's the thing. This is a Super Famicom game from the developers that went on to make Retro Game Challenge, and it came out in 1998.
Holy crap.
What? Wow.
That sounds amazing.
Stay tuned for that. Probably not next week, but the week after.
Wow. Well, also from the developers of Retro Game Challenge, I found out from some videos that America's Test Kitchen Let's Get Cooking, which is terrible grammar, is basically Personal Trainer Cooking 2. I mean, it's it looks exactly the same. It's just got 300 new recipes. So depending on what kinds of recipes, that was actually my main complaint about Personal Trainer Cooking, is there weren't enough American recipes. It was kind of a pathetic selection and of a country with a great cuisine. So I think America's Test Kitchen will probably have a lot more.
I would
American
think so.
They come with a Stars and Stripes chef hat.
Right. Maybe we can also get some, John, if you could look into getting us some more hands-on time with everyone's favorite game.
What, Disaster?
Disaster Day of Crisis.
I'll put that on my agenda.
Yeah, come on. I mean, you watch Cobra.
No, that put me in the mood for it.
Jesus, you imagine a disaster type game, but of Cobra?
Oh, yes. That, yes, I can.
You just want Man
quick
Cobra.
Quick time gun twirling, and then he puts it back in the...
It's not related to Cobra Triangle, right?
No, it definitely isn't. It says Cobra Triangle has merit.
I don't care. I don't shop here.